You ever hear a story so good, you're not sure it's real? I mean, you're sitting there at the airport diner, coffee's gone cold, and somebody starts telling you about a flying boat that went around the entire world because it couldn't go home the way it came. And you think, nah, come on. But this one's true, every word of it. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair for this one, because it's one of the greatest flights most people have never heard of. December 7th, 1941. We all know what happened that morning at Pearl Harbor. But here's something you probably haven't thought about. When those bombs started falling, Pan American Airways had flying boats scattered all across the Pacific, and one of them, a Boeing 314 called the Pacific Clipper, was on the far side of the ocean, way out in New Zealand, when the world changed forever. Now, before I get into what happened next, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. So picture this, Captain Robert Ford and a crew of 10 are sitting in Auckland, New Zealand on the morning of December 8th. Local time, they've just finished the outbound leg of a routine Pacific run, San Francisco to Honolulu to Midway to Wake Island to Guam and so on, down to Auckland. That was the route. That was how they'd come, and that was how they expected to go home. Then the radio message comes in from Pan Am headquarters in New York. Do not, under any circumstances, attempt to return via the Pacific. The Japanese have attacked, Wake Island is under siege. Guam is falling, Midway is threatened. Every stepping stone they'd used to cross the Pacific is either destroyed or about to be. The entire route home has just vanished. Now here's where it gets interesting. The orders from Pan Am were simple in concept and staggering in execution. Go west, keep going west, fly all the way around the world, and bring that airplane home. Think about that for a second. This is 1941. There's no GPS, there's no satellite communication. Half the world is at war, and the other half is about to be. And you're flying a 68,000-pound flying boat with four 1,400 horsepower, Wright Cyclone engines, an airplane designed to land on water across continents and oceans. It was never meant to see. Captain Ford didn't hesitate. He gathered his crew. His first officer was John Henry Mack. The flight engineer was Homeric Swede Roth. The navigator was Rod Brown. These men had signed up to fly a milk run across the Pacific, and now they were being asked to do something no commercial aircraft had ever done. Circumnavigate the globe. Under wartime conditions with no ground support, no spare parts, no certainty they'd make it. They left Auckland and headed for the South Pacific. First stop was Noumea in New Caledonia. From there, they pushed on to Gladstone, Australia. And already, the problems started. See, a Boeing 314 flying boat was a magnificent machine, but she was built for ocean routes with Pan Am's infrastructure. She needed specialized fuel. She needed calm, sheltered water for takeoffs and landings. She needed maintenance facilities, and out here in the backwaters of a world at war, none of that existed. In Australia, they had to scrounge fuel wherever they could find it. The octane ratings were wrong. The fuel they could get was meant for trucks and cars, not 1,400 horsepower radial engines. Swede Roth, the flight engineer, had to do calculations on the fly, figuring out how to nurse those big Wright cyclones on fuel that could foul plugs or cause detonation. The man earned his paycheck on this trip, I'll tell you that. From Australia, they crossed the Indian Ocean to the city then known as Surabaya in the Dutch East Indies, what we now call Indonesia. They were threading a needle. The Japanese were pushing south fast, islands were falling like dominoes. Ford had to time his departures so they weren't caught on the water by enemy aircraft. A flying boat sitting on the surface is about the most defenseless thing in aviation. Big, slow, full of fuel, and impossible to hide. They pressed on to Trincomalee in Ceylon, what's now Sri Lanka. Then across the Indian subcontinent to Karachi, and every stop was the same drill. Scrounge fuel, check the engines. Patch what needed patching. Sleep when you could, which wasn't much. They had no charts for half these legs. Rod Brown, the navigator, was using whatever maps they could buy, borrow, or steal. National Geographic maps, Admiralty charts from the last war. He was shooting celestial fixes with a sextant, the way mariners had done it for centuries, only he was doing it from a vibrating cockpit at 10,000 feet. Now, I want you to think about what this felt like from the inside. These were civilians. Pan Am flying boat captains were the rock stars of commercial aviation. Sure, they wore sharp uniforms and they knew their business, but they weren't military pilots. They hadn't trained for combat zones, and here they were, crossing territories where a wrong turn or a bad bit of luck could put them face to face with enemy fighters or anti-aircraft fire. And they couldn't talk about it. Radio silence was the rule. Every transmission was a risk. The Japanese were listening. The Germans were listening. Ford and his crew flew hours and hours over open ocean with nothing but the sound of those four radials drumming away. No contact with anyone. No way to call for help if an engine quit or the weather turned ugly. From Karachi, they flew across the Middle East. They landed in Bahrain for fuel. then on to Khartoum in the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan. And here's a detail I love when they landed on the Nile River at Khartoum. The British authorities had no idea what to make of them. A Pan-American flying boat, an American commercial airliner, coming in out of the eastern sky in the middle of a war. They were nearly impounded until Ford could convince the British that yes, they were who they said they were, and no, they weren't spies. From Khartoum, they flew across Central Africa to Leopoldville in the Belgian Congo, what's now Kinshasa. They landed on the Congo River, and now they faced the hardest decision of the entire trip, the Atlantic crossing. There's no flying boat route across the South Atlantic, with Pan Am ground stations and weather reports. There's just 3,000 miles of open water between Africa and South America. Ford chose the narrowest crossing he could find, Leopoldville to Natal, Brazil, with a stop in the tiny port of Fish Lake in Liberia. And they made that crossing on faith, on Rod Brown's celestial navigation, on Swede Rotha's engine management, and on whatever luck they had left after 3 weeks of flying into the unknown. They hit Natal right on the money. Brown's navigation was perfect. From Natal, they island hopped up through the Caribbean, Trinidad, then up to the Pan Am Basin, New York. On January 6, 1942, exactly 1 month after leaving Auckland, the Pacific Clipper touched down in the waters off LaGuardia Field's Marine Air Terminal in New York. Captain Robert Ford and his crew of 10 had flown 31,500 miles. They had crossed the Pacific, the Indian Ocean, Africa, and the Atlantic. They had done it in a flying boat that was never designed for such a journey, on scrounged fuel, with improvised charts, through war zones, with no ground support and no way to call for help. And you know what happened when they landed? Pan Am's Atlantic Division manager, a man who had no idea they were coming because they'd maintained radio silence for most of the trip, looked at them like they were ghosts. He'd heard the Pacific Clipper was out there somewhere, but nobody knew if she'd make it. Nobody knew if Ford and his crew were alive or dead, or sitting in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. They'd brought her home, every engine still running, every crew member accounted for, 1 month, 31,500 miles, around the world the hard way. Now here's the thing that gets me about this story every time I tell it. Robert Ford was 35 years old. 35, he'd been a Pan Am captain for just a couple of years, and when the world fell apart around him, he didn't panic. He didn't wait for somebody to come rescue him. He took his crew and his airplane and he flew home, west, the long way around. That's airmanship. Not stick and rudder skills, though Lord knows they needed those too. I'm talking about the deeper stuff, the decision-making, the leadership, the ability to look at an impossible situation and say, all right, here's what we're going to do. You know, we sit around hangars and we tell stories about engine failures and weather encounters and close calls. And those are good stories, but every now and then you hear one that reminds you what human beings are capable of when they refuse to quit. Ford and his crew didn't have a manual for flying around the world in a war. They wrote the manual as they went. And that old Boeing 314, the Pacific Clipper herself, she went on to serve the Naval Air Transport Service for the rest of the war. She'd proven what she was made of. They all had this story came together from Ed Dover's book The Long Way Home and several accounts from the Pan Am Historical Foundation, which does incredible work preserving these stories. You can find more at radiohangar.com. 31,500 miles, scrounged fuel, and borrowed maps. Sometimes the best flights are the ones nobody planned. See you next time.